Hello and welcome to Rule of Carnage, a podcast and video series where I, Mike Hutchinson, and this man, Glenn Ford, discuss the art of designing better miniature games. Tonight we are going to talk about a topic that is very dear to both of our hearts, which is rules that appear to have no purpose. Glenn, have you got a further definition of this topic for us?
I've written on my notes, fight the hegemony. So there are rules. I don't have a good definition, but I have a slightly rambling version of one.
That's the only kind we hold truck with around here, so ramble on.
There are rules that turn up in so many tabletop miniatures war games. They are presumed almost, I think, in some rule sets. It's just like, well, this is the way that it happens, and so I'll just write that one in, cut and paste from everything else. And there are some things that are inherent to the form, to do with having miniatures and a tabletop and stuff on it. Whereas there are some that absolutely positively are not, and it's bizarre that they are as ubiquitous as they seem to be in rule sets. So I think the best way to explain what I'm talking about is to open out with an example of one that we have mentioned previously on the podcast and is just bafflingly ubiquitous, but is always there to the point where you can skip certain chunks of rules because you know what's coming in the brackets after it. And that is that you cannot re-roll a re-roll, and the second result stands even if it is worse. And I don't on any level understand why you cannot re-roll a re-roll. And I think that what's going to be tricky about discussing this particular rule is that neither of us are going to be willing to play devil's advocate for it, because
it doesn't make any sense. Like, I guess, okay, I will try and play devil's advocate. Like, if we all have rerolls all day long, then presumably the game can descend into a single dice being rerolled as many times as we have resources to reroll it, and that would perhaps lead to silliness. But
why did I give you that many rerolls? you chose how many rerolls the players had. Why did you say every player gets 472 rerolls?
But that goes to my very common design rule of thumb, which is every time I write the word any number, then I take any number and I replace it with a number. I don't know what the right number is. Maybe it's 2. Maybe it's 7. But like, never put any number in any rule ever.
Yeah. Pick a number at random. You might discover it's the wrong number.
Because you, in 4 years' time, will write a rule that's just like, oh, that would be brilliant, except that this thing can infinitely loop over here. Anyway, yes. So maybe that's the reason. Like, a dice can be rerolled any number of times. Really, Glenn? Any number of times? No, a dice can be rerolled 7 times at a maximum.
I mean, the thing, whether or not you think that there's an upper limit, and I'm pretty sure that I'm okay with saying a dice can be re-rolled any number of times, primarily because that's not a process that's going to infinitely loop, because you're going to get the number that you want before you hit infinity.
That's true. And that's, you know, highly likely.
Provided there's an upper limit to what one dice gives, there's no reason to write in, here's a rule that I think you should consider. You can spend 1 re-roll to re-roll the dice, or you can spend 3 re-rolls to pick a face of the dice.
Yeah, just choose it. But also, why should the second result stand? Why can't I just spend a re-roll to get 2 chances?
Yeah, why can't I? Okay, spend a re-roll, keep the dice you originally rolled, roll a second dice, pick between 2 of them. Why does the second result stand even if it is worse? Because all that does is it limits the level of strategic choice players have. Because it's like, if the dice result is passable, I never re-roll it because it could get worse. So I just wait and the dice roll is a flat fail and then I re-roll it. It's less interesting. It's less fun.
So I think, like, let's find some other ones because these are fun. I think that potentially what's going on here is that there is a tension between two things. One is the palatability or the learnability of the rule system, because it just does things that are like de rigueur. They're just the things that happen here. Do we have to relearn this rule? Is it different? No, it isn't. It's exactly the same. And that's lovely. And that's less brain ache and general cognitive overhead. But it's at the expense of design space, because we've just come up with a couple of interesting ways that the reroll rule could have been written differently, thus giving us as games designers more space, more design space to design in. But that comes at the point where, like, everyone has to come to this game and go, oh, by the way, this is one of the, like, three games in existence that doesn't have the normal reroll role, and we have to tell each other about that before we start.
But I give you a sweetie for learning it. I give you choice, power, and options. I make the game funner. It's one thing making you learn, okay, in this game you discard cards face down for no discernible reason. It doesn't help in any way, shape, or form. I just don't like face-up discard piles. That's just how I am. And it's another thing when you say, okay, look, you can re-roll a re-roll, and you can choose to keep the old reroll. Now you've got choices. Every time you should I try and spend a reroll to get a better result? Because I'm not junking the success. I might just be bettering it, you know? And that, I think that's the important thing, is a lot of the things we're going to talk about are assumed rules. And so they do make life easier for the players. And there's a whole bunch of things that I'm not going to talk about because they're fine. They're fine. The thing with these ones, I think we're going to try and talk about in this conversation, is they're just better if you have a different version. I just think you cannot re-roll a re-roll is just a worse rule than you can.
There's another, just because maybe it's one of those categories that you decided you wouldn't want to talk about, but like in games with tape measures, you tend to measure from a point on the base, and then that point on the base travels the distance that the tape measure counts. Except in Gaslands, where you pick up the thing and you stick it at the other end, and it's ridiculous because it travels a varying amount of time distance depending on how long it is. So that in Gaslands, although it uses movement templates, so like the whole measuring is blown up anyway. Like, do you measure front to front? No, in this game, for some reason, you measure front to back and weird stuff emerges. And people often trip over on that. So maybe, like, you know, the ubiquitous rule of, like, when a model moves, it obviously only travels the distance. Like, that's a common sense thing. Like, going back to the 60s books that I'm reading, like, the way that they describe movement, it's just transparent that if a toy soldier travels 6 inches, it travels 6 inches. Like, we know what that means physically. It's not, well, do you measure it from front to back, thus giving it an extra inch and a half? No, that would be 7.5 inches. It hasn't traveled 6 inches. What are you talking about, man?
And I think exactly what I'm saying is that those sorts of rules about where you measure to and from, I'm not going to talk about because they make perfect sense. There's a very good reason why that is the standardized version of doing it. And the reason... the reason that Gaslands gets away with it is that Gaslands has a tactile system whereby you snap down a template and you jam it into the front of the thing, and then you slide the thing down it, and when it snaps down on the other end of it, that's the correct thing you've done. You know, frankly, X-Wing does exactly the same thing because it has a tactile nature of moving the thing around. It gets away with it. And there was a very, very early conversation I seem to remember one day having, where somebody said, well, what you should do is you should draw out on the end of the template the footprint of a car, and it should be outlined, and what you do is you push down the template until you're overlapping that footprint, and then slide the template out from under it, and that's where the car goes to. And it's just like, well, that's an appalling pain in the ass for people to go through. You were going to say something there, I think.
Oh, so another rule that's somewhat ubiquitous, but I found an alternative to today is when you roll a dice, the success band and the successful results and the unsuccessful results should be contiguous. And today I found a war game in which the numbers 1, 3. And 6 are hits, and the numbers 2, 4, and 5 are misses. And I was so delighted by this. It's just the most wonderful piece of madness I've ever seen.
These are supposed to be...
Because it's not even like odd numbers hit and even numbers miss. No.
Look, these are supposed to be examples of presumed rules that people should consider not following. That rule is absolutely mad.
It's non-contiguous.
Mind-boggling.
numbers.
Why? And what drove me insane about that example is it's three numbers and three numbers. If it were like...
Yeah, no, it's just a 50-50.
It's a 50-50 coin. It's a literal coin flip. If it were two numbers and four numbers and one number and five, I could understand where it's like one, two, four misses. Four,
yeah, just you could draw a bell curve and it'd be like, well, one and a six of misses because they're rubbishy numbers and you just want those nice ones in the middle or what, you know.
Yeah, I could comprehend it, but when it's just this is just a coin flip and it's okay, they want the six to be the critical hit because six is the biggest number, then you obviously do six, four and two. You obviously do evens hit and odds miss. Why in all that's holy would you do one, three and six as hits?
It's opened up vistas for me. Non-contiguous dice mechanics, it's my new
thing. I mean, There are vistas viable to open up. This is not one of them. All right, okay.
Look. All right, sorry, I've delayed us long enough. Where were you going next?
Okay, one that Mike, I suspect, is going to at least attempt to defend is one's always miss and six is always hit. Why does that rule exist? And as an example, now Mike always puts this into his games. The other day, myself and Mike and some friends were playing Arkham Horror. Mm. And in Arkham Horror, there's an auto-fail token, and the auto-fail token came out, and Mike went, see, this just makes the game worse. It just makes the game worse that there is a result that for no reason means that no matter what you've done, you always fail. And I said, well, some people choose to put that rule into their game, Mike. And I don't understand why you put it into games. I don't understand why anybody puts it into games. If I want to put in a set of modifiers that mean that a player auto-succeeds or auto-fails, I'll put those modifiers in. And if I don't want to put those modifiers in, I won't put them in. And then sixes will always succeed and ones will always fail because there aren't the modifiers to make a six fail and a one succeed. Why write that rule in? It's just limiting the rule space. You do believe in that rule and you've said you'll go to bat for it. So I'm going to
go to bat for it in a couple of places. So the place that it was most useful as a design tool was in A Billion Suns, where I was designing this funky little to hit system where the silhouette of a ship can be quite large. It can be up to like 10. And then when you've rolled to hit, you pick up the dice and you re-roll them and you try and get a save. And so one of the things that's really useful about having sixes always fail is that a ship with a really large shield value can still be penetrated by a teeny tiny little weapon. And that's narratively very exciting and interesting because what it means is that you get a moment of... what could have been a moment of nothing, and I will address the fact that this creates another moment of nothing, but the moment of nothing is, I have a little A-wing fighter flying towards a battleship, it's got a pea shooter, battleship's got like shields of seven or something, so it can't be penetrated by this thing. Like that's a boring moment where flying the A-wing into the Star Destroyer's bridge and therefore causing some kind of chaotic damage, critical damage, cannot happen. So by putting auto fails and auto succeeds in, or at the very least auto fails, what you say is, okay, there's an opportunity for a one to always successfully hit, and there's an opportunity for a six in this case to automatically fail. So like an always 1/36th chance of like the A-wing managing to make it through the laser barriers and into the bridge of the ship and do some kind of critical damage. And that felt very important within the mechanisms of that system. And so it was very appropriate, I think, to put in shields are not perfect. All weapons have at least an outside chance of doing something. Certainty is less interesting at the table in the moment than some amount of uncertainty, because when I go to roll the dice, if I know that all six results are going to succeed, then there's a little moment of sort of something taken away. Now, it's not true in all cases, because if you play for it, then there's a moment of like, well, I played and won.
Mm. And also, like I say, as with the rerolls, you It's only not certain that a six can always hit and a one can always fail, because you then write rules that mean that sometimes that's not true. If you want that to not be true, just don't write the rule. It's like you're writing a rule to overrule the rule that you're later on going to write as a rule.
It's also the steam valve on the top of a pressure cooker, right? Like, it's somewhat related to the never write a rule with any number written in it, which is that I can bodge up writing my expanded rules, my perks or my special skills or my, you know, magical weapon rules. I can bodge them up a bit because there's always this escape valve of sixes and ones, whereby I can accidentally create situations that give me too many modifiers or that stack on top of each other because I haven't spotted it but the players did, or I left it in or whatever. But then it's sort of like, well, yeah, sure, you can do that slightly cheesy thing where all the things add up, but you know that there's always going to be a 1 in 6 chance that it doesn't work out the way that you wanted it to. And so that gives an escape valve to the system. Whether that's a desirable thing, I think, is quite dependent on the game. It's even more dependent on the situation within the game, because there might be cases where played for and got feels satisfying, but I don't know, but I would wager that there are an equal or greater number of moments where it's like, well, that was annoying because I couldn't do anything about it.
That seems like a good place to take a quick break.
I mean, I think my position on this particular subject is that there is a presumed mindset, which is there should always be a chance. There should always be an option for the lowliest fighter to defeat the most skilled fighter in the world. And whether or not you think that that should be the situation, I have a problem with that being the assumed mindset. That I think that's my position on this one, is that if that's your opinion, you want it to be like, okay, you know, little Dirk with his tiny, tiny dagger can defeat the mighty giant with a lucky hit. That's cool. Don't assume that it should always be true, that there is always a chance.
Because you could be writing a game in which, like, part of the game is to correctly amass your pressure and forces such that the overwhelming situation certainly resolves there, and that might have meant that it's uncertain over there, but like your direction of force led to at least some control of the odds. And if that's what your game's about, then yeah, absolutely, ones and sixes don't make any sense in that case.
Yeah, and I think if there's a rule to be had in relation to these weird little clunky rules, it's to not assume anything in your thinking, you know, not certainly not fall into an assumed version of thinking about things where you go, well, there should always be a chance. It is inherently always more exciting for every game system that there should always be a chance. That's, I think, the most dangerous thing in the world, is to just fall into that thing of everybody enjoys that, you know, all people like it, it works for every system. That's the one thing that is never true. It's never true that everything always works for any given system. Mm-hmm. I think some of these are going to get a little bit more situational as we go on, because those are my two personal big sort of
those are the biggies.
Here are some other slightly more random ones. Is that if you involuntarily leave a table edge, you can never come back on again. Every time somebody involuntarily leaves a table edge, you can voluntarily leave a table edge and come back again. You can be chasing somebody off and come back off again. But if you run off the table whilst afraid, you can never rally and return back on, despite the fact that obviously it's historically accurate that various units flee the field of battle and, you know, reconvene and then charge back on again from a completely different situation and win the entire battle. I don't understand why if you flee off the battlefield, you're auto-deleted, no matter what size the unit happens to be. I don't know any games where you can flee off the battlefield and then think better of it, because you've only gone, like, sometimes 1 inch further. It's like 1 inch this way and you can totally rally and turn the battle in somebody's favor, 1 inch that way, and suddenly you fall into a, the entire battlefield is lined with a flaming chasm of doom that you can jump over if you're chasing somebody, but if you're being chased, you go straight into the chasm of doom. I don't know, I literally don't know why that's the standard for being scared off of a table. It doesn't seem like it's massively more bookkeeping. It doesn't seem like it makes narrative sense. It doesn't seem like it makes simulationist sense. It's just,
well, I suppose the one maybe that I could see is if you're running off, then you could say to yourself, "Ah, well, they're going to have to keep randomly rolling to run in that direction, and so it's going to be very difficult to track where they are." But of course, perhaps they automatically rally the second they leave the table, and therefore, involuntarily or voluntarily, you would just be set aside and ready to come back on. But, or you could have them making rally checks whilst they're off the table. That's not particularly.
You could just have rally checks, and you can have reinforcements. And if somebody rallies when they're off the table, they join your reinforcements list and they come in like a normal reinforcement. Tons of games with reinforcement lists that don't let you rally. Random one. Lower things are always visible to higher things. There are no ditches in the world of wargaming, because actual history is replete with examples where somebody's like, "Oh, the cavalry went into some lower ground, and so they couldn't be seen." And they
this is where you need to be playing true line of sight, Glenn. Full sand table.
Nobody uses true line of sight when there are hills. Every time I've ever gone to a tournament with a true line of sight game, it's always, okay, we playing mountains or redwoods. Either trees arbitrarily block line of sight to everything and they're infinitely tall, or everything on a hill arbitrarily sees over everything else. Nobody ever goes, "Well, we'll use true line of sight for this hill," because everyone goes, "Well, yeah, but the hill is like an inch." Every hill on every tabletop is the height of a single man. Yeah. That's obviously
it's a hummock.
Is obviously insane. Obviously, the hill that I'm stood on is the height of 3 or 4 men. We all know that. We all agree it. So we're not going to bother doing true line of sight for a hill. We'll just say, "I can see over you." Nothing, you know, no rule set ever says if you're on a higher thing. And what's weird about it, what's really weird about it, is if you're on a building, there are often rules saying you have to be within X many inches of the edge of the building to be able to see something stood right below the building. It never says that for hills. It never says that for valleys. It never says that for ditches and hummocks and natural features, because for some reason, buildings are way harder to see through than massive mounds of dirt. If anything, hills have hummocks within them. Sometimes somebody's running up a hill towards you and they legitimately go into an area where you can't see them anymore. If someone's climbing up the side of a building, I can see them all the way up. There's no, buildings don't have dips and divots in them. Why aren't there more rules for divots hiding things from people on higher ground? It's just,
well, you know, maybe it's just modeled into the to hit roll, you know. Maybe the reason you're on fives to hit is because they're, you know, partially running through a divot.
Equally on that particular subject, archery acting as actual archery, and I know that this is getting very sort of historical gamery, you know, and Grognardian, and I'm not going to go into it a lot, but why does all archery need direct line of sight when it's called archery? Because it involves, you know, arches. There's one that we've talked about a lot, I think, on this channel before, and that's assumed charge advantage. Mm. That if something charges, it inherently.
That's less a rule specifically that is assumed, and more just like a general sense that I punched you, therefore I should get the upper hand.
Yeah, I mean, the number of rule sets I read that don't assume that because I'm doing the charging, I get a magical extra juicy bonus. It's virtually unheard of. The rule set doesn't give you a bonus. And if anything, as we've said before, if someone's charging, they've picked the combat. That's the bonus they get. If anything, the person being charged should be getting a bonus to even out the bonus the other person's getting through having chosen the combat. Giving the person who's choosing the combat the additional bonus of extra attacks or a plus one to hit or extra movement or whatever thing it is that you've decided that people magically get because they've, you know...
But Glenn, if you don't give them that, they ask for it.
People ask for all sorts of things that aren't good for them.
I'm racking my brain to think of any of these other
one that bugs me is everyone gets a leader, pick someone to be the leader, they arbitrarily get better. The way that leaders get chosen is that leaders are the best. And therefore they become the leader. We don't pick somebody and then they magically grow an extra foot because they got chosen as the leader. It bugs the hell out of me, especially when a very narrative campaign-based system with like, oh, these people will have names and relationships. And it goes, oh, and just pick one and he's now got an extra point of something that makes him better than everybody else. And everyone gets one. So it's not even an interesting advantage, because everyone gets one, everyone arbitrarily gets an extra point onto one of their dues, and that person is arbitrarily called the leader. And you know what? A lot of the time, their being leader doesn't really even do anything. They just get to wear the leader hat and be the leader. And you go, oh, is that your leader? Yeah, it's your leader. You get 50 points for killing him? Yes, you do. Oh, well, that's brilliant.
One other one that happens in almost every game, and when it doesn't happen, I'm delighted by it, is when a model loses all its wounds, it gets taken off the table. There are so many more interesting things to do with a model than just take it straight off the table. There are a few games that do it, mostly skirmish games where they're like, you know, models fall over or whatever. Or when things get taken off right at the end all in one go. But I guess we've been meddling around with it a bit with Gaslands recently. But yeah, like, when stuff dies, should it just disappear? Is that really the only design space there?
I mean, the thing about Gaslands is, of course, that when cars get destroyed, they turn into wrecks, and wrecks have a gameplay purpose. Mm. And yes, if you've got models, miniatures are markers. Corpses have an effect on people, you know. Why every time one of these markers starts having a different effect from the one it did normally, do we remove it from the tabletop?
One does it occasionally in games of 40K, particularly if you were playing Warhammer 40,000 in the 90s or whatever. Like when, and I did it recently with Adeptus Titanic as well. Like once a Titan explodes, I put down a massive pancake token, which I've stuck bits of broken and burnt Titan to, and then that becomes a piece of terrain. I think for the same reason that, you know, it's a big vehicle structure, and so when it dies, it feels like it doesn't just slump into the mud and disappear. It has a gameplay impact. And Sean Sutter's Sludge War does the same thing. Like as people die, they basically turn into like puddles of gore, and that affects the psychology around them.
One of my favorite rules in Warhammer is the falling giant, where it says tip over the giant, anything overlapped by the model is squashed by the falling giant. Is why aren't there more, you know, rules about that? Why is it that, you know, the corpse of my friend remains upsetting to me however many times I walk past it during a battle, rather than, you know, he's dead. It upset me at the moment he died. I got over it pretty quickly. I'm all right now, actually. He didn't mean that much to me. Those are a handful of weird little assumed rules that I would argue turn up more than they deserve to, don't have any inherent logical reason to be the way they were. Like I say, we, you know, the two at the top, I think, are the ones that really, you know.
I mean, honestly, I think you can't reroll a reroll is simply a Games Workshop house style. Like at someone in the design studio, whether it was, you know, whether it was Jervis Johnson or someone else just decided that was a thing, and then everyone just put it in. And so because we're all brought up on those rule books, we all just put it in our rule book as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and the thing is, because I was thinking about this subject sort of as scratching out a few notes of some of these weirder rules, and I'm very conscious of the fact that there are going to be some of these rules that I'm not aware that I've taken as a presumption for writing rules. You know, it's like I'm aware that you cannot re-roll a re-roll is somebody else's style choice and has then visited upon the whole of tabletop gaming. And every single time I pick up a rule set and I flick through it, it says you cannot re-roll a re-roll and the previous result stands, even if it was, you know, the new result stands, even if it's worse. A little chime goes off in my head and I go, why? And then I go on to the next page. There are going to be some, though, because the person who wrote that rule set, you know, is feeling exactly the same way about that reroll rule as I'm feeling about some of the rules that I'm putting into the games that I'm writing or working on. He's not aware that he's put that rule in and it doesn't exist for a reason, you know, and there's no reason to think that I'm not doing the same thing somewhere. Mm-hmm. I suppose if there's a rule here, if there's a game design principle, it is be vigilant, you know.
Question everything.
Be forever vigilant, question everything. But just when you put a rule in, question what it does to the design space of your game. Question the value that it gives you, putting it in that way, and just give yourself a quick sort of counterfactual version of, okay, what's the rule that's the complete opposite of that? What does that rule do? And if the complete opposite of that rule does absolutely nothing, remove the entire rule because it wasn't doing anything. And if the complete opposite of that rule does something interesting, consider doing the complete opposite. You know, consider giving people choices. Don't write a rule because that's the way that rule has always been written. A lot of the time, other people know better than you do. And a lot of the time, there is a history of intelligent choices. You know what? Some of the time, there is a history of arbitrary choices. And they're not bad. And the opposite isn't inherently better. But they're just arbitrary. They're a coin flip. The you cannot re-roll a re-roll is just a coin flip. Someone just picked that to be the rule. And it's not bad. But there's no reason for it. And, you know, just stop and question and figure out whether the rules that you're writing into your game exist for reasons or exist because somebody made a style choice at some point 20 or 30 years ago and you've just fallen into that pit.
And the other rule is if you just rewrite the Warhammer stat line and give it different names. I see you. I see you. right, good. I think we've flog that horse.
I think we've run through that one. I think that was good fun. You know, I hope people enjoyed that. If you have enjoyed it, please like and subscribe. If you have rules that you think we've missed out that we're blind to, because there must be some out there that you think don't exist for a reason and you see in every single rule set you ever look at, please drop it into the comment section. I genuinely want to hear some of these. I want to try and pick them out and hunt them down because they need to be hunted out and questioned and ferreted and chewed up. If you didn't particularly like what we did here, if you think we've gotten too rambling and we shouldn't record these things quite so late at night, please let us know in the comments section. We'll try and improve in the future. Either way, look us up on social media. It's been fun chatting and we'll say goodbye for this episode of Rule Carnage.
Bye-bye.